Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel and Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel and Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You are listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel and Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
Hit the music. It's Saturday, it's just after 11, and you know what that means? It's time for the Live Science Radio Show.
Wow, what a totally amazing, excellent discovery.
It will test your head, and your mind, and your brain, too.
Come on, let's go, space trucker!
Good morning, this Bank Holiday, May Day Bank Holiday weekend,
yes.
Saturday the 4th of May 2024, in case you're listening on catch up. You're listening to Sheffield Live 93.2 FM, of course, on digital in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. And it's time for the Live Science Radio Show yet again. You've got Julian Paul here live. We'll be talking to our PG later in the show. He'll be talking about guess what? Bits and pieces again.
Okay.
But anyway, we should have a guest speaker today. It should be Phil Muffett from the Mexpert Swinton Astronomical Society. But, you know, he's a busy man. He does a lot for us. He does a lot for other people. And he's been off on a big trip. Is it the 500-mile?
Yes, in Scotland.
Scotland. It's an epic. And also, it's coming up to quite a significant birthday on Bank Holiday Monday, the 6th of May. So a very, very happy birthday to Mr. Phil Muffett. You are officially amazing, and thanks from everyone here at Sheffield Live for all you do for us on the Live Science Radio Show. He loves it. He's got a massive fan base everywhere. He's going to make T-shirts, he said, this year. We'll see. Anyway, all being well, next week and every second Saturday of the month, our guest speaker will be Dr. Ogo Osomo. Usually talking about environmental stuff. Who knows what he'll be talking about? Next up, a quick reminder about a couple of things happening locally.
Yes, it's the Pint of Science Festival in Sheffield, Monday 13th to Wednesday 15th of May. The world's largest festival of public science is set to return to Sheffield next month, with scientists from the University of Sheffield taking to the city's pubs and venues to share their scientific discoveries. Sheffield joins nearly 500 cities across 25 countries around the world, taking part in the 12th year of the Global Festival. Tickets on sale now.
Yeah, it's not far off, is it?
And then Festival of Debate, which runs until Saturday the 25th of May 2024. This year's South Yorkshire Festival, mainly based in Sheffield, has been programmed to explore three core questions, including how can we respond to the climate crisis and biosphere collapse. That's www.festivalofdebate.com. com.
And just the other day, I saw this in the news and I thought, this is an interesting one. Scientists work to make healthier white breads. So scientists are trying to create a new type of bread that is just as healthy as wholemeal, but looks and tastes like white bread. The project is actually funded by the UK government in order to improve the health benefits of UK food. So the researchers plan to add small amounts of peas, beans and cereals to the bread mix, as well as bran and wheat germ that are normally removed from white flour. So bread makers have attempted to make their white loaves healthier in the past by adding bran to their flour, but their customers didn't like the taste and texture. And of course, it's all about what you get used to eating. If you tuned in last week, of course, you would have listened to Chris Dale's continuous theme about diet and health and the state of the nation. He was telling me the other day about McDonald's are planning on developing an even larger burger, as if there ain't enough calories in the ones they sell anyway. But
that must be very odd. Well, develop a larger one.
Well, I think they're on about putting one out there. But anyway, so Dr. Catherine Haworth of Aberystwyth University said, scientists had begun to analyse the detailed chemical composition of existing white flour. She said boosting its nutritional values to the levels of wholemeal bread whilst keeping the taste and feel of white bread was a delicate balancing act. She said it involved adding back smaller quantities of the wheat germ and part of the bran that is actually taken out in the milling process for white bread, as well as adding other grains into that mix that are richer in vitamins, minerals and fibre, such as quinoa, teff, sorghum and millet. Now, to me, I hadn't heard of two of them, and millet, I would associate it with feeding birds. But anyway, so green peas and chickpeas would provide extra protein in this new white bread. So an early prototype of the new white bread is made from a mixture of normal white flour and some added grains and peas, making it crustier than the white loaves you normally get from the supermarket. But otherwise, it looks and tastes like white bread. The research team believe that their approach will lead to a successful product because they are adding only the inner layer of the bran, which is less strongly flavoured and coloured. And they can add less of it because they are using other highly nutritious but less strongly flavoured grains. They're saying that further development and testing is needed, but it's hoped that the new product could be on the supermarket shelf in about 2 years' time. Now, this is the interesting one. Currently, white bread has to have minerals and vitamins added to it by law to make up for the goodness that's lost in the refining process. So wholemeal bread is made from flour milled from the entire grain, and that's why what we mean by whole grain. White bread uses only the endosperm part of the grain. Most people know that wholemeal bread is better for you, but a lot of them are put off by the flavour or because it's not what they are used to. And I'm interested to think that it's probably because it's not what they're used to eating. Now, according to the British Diabetic Association, BDA, the risk of heart disease, stroke and type 2 diabetes may be up to 30% lower in people who regularly eat whole grains, and the risk of bowel cancer may also be reduced. The British Diabetic Association says surveys show that 95% of adults don't eat enough whole grains, and nearly one in three of us, that's a third of us, don't get any at all. We'll be right back. Bit of Bread fan there. That was Budgie. Amazing. From 1973. We played that because guess what? Scientists want to work to make a healthier white bread. I've just checked up on this story about the McDonald's burger. Yeah, McDonald's are looking to make a bigger, a more filling burger because it's saying the customers want better value and they're testing it across the world. Very interesting stuff. If you just tuned in, listen to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire. Or SheffieldLive.org. So this week's environment update. Oh, all sorts of stuff happening. Yet another UK harvest warning. UK harvests of key crops could decline by as much as a fifth this year because of climate-induced washout winter. That's according to the Energy and Climate Intelligence Unit. The research body found that yields of wheat, barley, oats and oilseed rape may be down more than 5 million tonnes compared with the average between 2015 and 2023. And that's a reduction of over 20%.
And there's hope for Amazon rainforest as fewer trees cut down. The rate at which the Amazon rainforest is being destroyed has fallen sharply after many years of logging, mining and fires. Projects led by indigenous communities and key changes of government in Brazil and Colombia have ensured a less gloomy prognosis for a vital weapon in the battle against a changing climate.
Indeed. Fossil fuel tax. A tax on fossil fuel extraction in the world's richest countries could raise £580 billion by 2030, according to a report backed by dozens of climate groups worldwide. The Climate Damages Tax report argues that the funds could help to bridge the gap in climate funding needed to accelerate decarbonisation in the world's most climate-vulnerable countries.
Next, the 31 billion tug-of-war over copper. There's a mine in Peru called the Quellaveco Copper Mine. It's one of the world's most bountiful new sources of copper, prized for its role in the green revolution and because of its use in electric cars, wind turbines and power networks. Once fully built, this 4.8 billion mine will be a length of about 28 football pitches.
Wow, and the tug of war is because another company is trying to take it over. I think it's a US company, maybe Australian, but it's in Peru. Very interesting. Next one's an interesting one. Goldman Gongs. The winners of the annual Goldman Prize for Grassroots Environmental Champions have been announced. These include Teresa Vincente, who helped save Europe's largest saltwater lagoon, an indigenous Australian activist who blocked the development of a coal mine on a vital nature reserve, and two men who successfully fought against seismic testing for oil and gas off South Africa's Eastern Cape.
We need them sort of people, don't we, really, for this world. Right, next. No to deep sea devastation. The High Seas Treaty has been ratified by the European Parliament, marking a boost for the landmark marine legislation. The United Nations Treaty is designed to conserve two-thirds of the world's waters that are not based within national jurisdictions. A lack of regulation in these areas has left them vulnerable to exploitation such as deep sea mining and oil extraction.
And finally, a very, very interesting one, this courts controversy, I guess. Self-digesting plastic. Scientists are currently developing a self-digesting plastic which could help reduce pollution. Polyurethane is used in everything from phone cases to trainers, but it is tricky to recycle and mainly ends up in landfill. However, researchers have now come up with a sci-fi-like solution. By incorporating spores of plastic-eating bacteria, they've developed a plastic that can self-destruct. Interesting. The spores remain dormant during the useful lifetime of the plastic, but spring back to life and start to digest the product when exposed to nutrients in compost. There's hope we can mitigate plastic pollution in nature, said researcher Han Sol Kim of the University of California, San Diego, La Jolla. Furthermore, there might be an added advantage in that the spores can increase the toughness of the plastic, making it more rugged and therefore extending its useful lifetime. Then, when it's done with and discarded, it can be eliminated from the environment regardless of how it's disposed. So the plastic is still currently under development, but could be in the real world within a few years. Now, interestingly, the type of bacteria added to the plastic is called Bacillus subtilis, which, would you believe, is already widely used as a food additive and a probiotic. Importantly, the bacteria has to be genetically engineered to make it able to withstand the very high temperatures needed to make plastic. A very interesting story, and unsurprisingly, not everyone is convinced by this idea of developing biodegradable alternatives to conventional plastics. And that's because some scientists argue it's far better to reduce the amount of actual plastic used in the first place.
Bam bam, mon chasse-place, j'ai sur mon lit à bouffer, ça n'en en buvant, prends mon whisky, quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris, mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash. En quatre couleurs, allez hop, un matin, une louloute est venue chez moi, coupée de cellophane, cheveux chinois, un sparadrap, une gueule de bois, a bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc. Comme un agneau dans son igloo, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, 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 ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi. Allez hop, la nana, quel panard, quelle vibration de s'envoyer sur paillasson, limé, ruiné, vidé, comblé. You are the king of the divan, qu'elle me dit en passant. Ooh, I am the king of the divan. Ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, 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 ça plane pour moi. Ooh, ça plane pour moi. Allez hop, t'occupe, t'inquiète, touche pas ma planète. Dès que le ciel me tombera sur la tête et que la colle me manquera. C'est marre à tout casser, l'évier, le bar me laissant seul, comme un grand connard. Le pied dans le plat, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, 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 ça plane pour moi.
Oh. Plastic Bertrand there with Sa Plan Pour Moi. We played that because we were talking about self-digesting plastic. Well, some argue we shouldn't be using as much plastic, never mind introducing something else into the world. But anyway, you listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. And we've got RPG on
Five,
the line.
Four... Three, two, one.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, all.
Good morning, this bank holiday, May Day bank holiday weekend.
I don't know, signing in on holidays.
I know. It's dedication, Paul, you know. Yeah. We can't just sit at home letting people watch the snooker, can we?
Well, no, I'll turn it off then.
Brilliant. Got you out. Hopefully it's gonna warm up a little bit. It feels like it is already.
Well, I think it's been weird, hasn't it? Because I think looking at so many of the sort of weather predictions, it's saying it's actually warmer than it should be. And that's really confusing.
Because it feels colder.
Yes.
It feels like winter.
Yeah, it's absolutely weird stuff. But I think one of the things I saw in the news which sort of brought a chill to my heart was that the Chablis area of France suffered a massive sort of storm with hailstones the size of ping pong balls, and that battered the vines. So, there might be a bit of a short supply on
of the posh
French
stuff.
Wines.
It's interesting. Do you know what I read only the other day, Paul, as well, about scientists have done some research looking at temperatures in London over the last 30 years, and they're saying, it's not good. You're looking at higher and higher peaks. I think 35 degrees, they were saying. A lot of that's happened in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's... the growth of the sort of wine industry in the UK.
Exactly.
We've actually got a vineyard up towards Leeds.
Yeah, I know.
You know, so it's a change, and I think the farmers now are talking widely about how they're going to be able to adapt to the amount of rainfall that's concentrated, the growing potential for crops.
Yeah.
So interesting, but you sort of commented on some of the people that trying to get the climate controls in place, and a strange place. But I went to Waitrose to buy some bits and pieces.
Oh, get you, Paul?
And I picked up their free papers. I'm a cheapskate, and they got a little side column which is good news in brief, and it says that. A group of Swiss women have won a climate change case against their government at the European Court of Human Rights. Senior Women for Climate Protection, whose members are mostly in their 70s, accuse their country of not doing enough to reduce emissions. In its first ever climate change ruling, the court agreed that the government's failures to act have breached the duty to protect its citizens. So good on you, ladies.
Oh, interesting. Yes. How did that find its way into Waitrose magazine?
Well, as I say, it was interesting. Also, there's another reminder in that column that a bit of good news for UK space travellers, that Rosemary Coogan, who's 33, has signed up as Britain's newest astronaut, who's set to fly into space by 2030. She's from Belfast, graduated from space training at the European Space Agency, and passed all the tests. And she follows Helen Sharman and Tim Peake as UK astronaut.
Wow. Was that in the Waitrose magazine as well?
Yeah. Amazing. Very interesting, I think.
But it's amazing. You know, Tesco's do magazines, other supermarkets do magazines. And you do get good snippets of often health information in amongst there. So it's quite educational in some respects.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely sort of nice. And I say, a bit of a good news column, I think that's something we could all do with it.
It is indeed, yeah.
So, and then I sort of looked at something on the Sheffield University sort of site on news for them. And they've been involved in a collaboration with a mobile power company to produce a range of batteries that are called MOPO, M-O-P-O. And they're longer life batteries that can be hired. So across six sub-Saharan African countries, they've been loaning out these batteries. And a collaboration between the company and Sheffield University developed the packages that they're doing. So it's a bit hard for us, I think, here because we've got mains power. But mains power in a lot of African countries is hit and miss. It's not always available. It's not always there. So with these batteries, they can actually power things like refrigerators, cooking, lighting, and charging things like mobile phones.
Yes.
So by renting them out, they've got a cloud-based platform so people can get on there and rent them. And they've already conducted more than 14 million battery rentals across these six countries. with the Mopo batteries. And they've got rentals in Nigeria, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Sierra Leone, Liberia, Chad and Uganda. So it's pretty good. That's engineers from the University of Sheffield who've been working with the company since 2017, developing their own research and development in line with input from the university. So it's developed this company. Professor Dan Gladwin, who's a professor of electronic and electrical engineering at the University of Sheffield, said more than 740 million people don't have access to electricity around the world.
It's staggering, yeah.
Wow. Yep.
And for many off-grid communities or those with unstable power networks, the only reliable source is things like petrol and diesel generators,
yes,
which are expensive
and dangerous.
They're pricing people out, and they're dangerous and damage the environment. So smarter batteries can play a major role in helping to connect communities. And I'll say this collaboration with Mopo is taking that out into more and more countries in Africa.
So, fantastic. It's an interesting one, that, because last week you were talking about things we take for granted, of which one was batteries, but also electricity. So if you're saying 740 million people across the world do not have access to electricity, that's staggering, isn't it?
Well, and I think one of the things that's sort of good to read is that in even the more developed countries in Africa, they're starting to use solar power for things like charging electric vehicles.
Yeah.
So because they've got plentiful sunshine in most of their countries, they can build these stations. And a long time ago, I read a development where they were using solar-powered charging stations for community charging areas for these batteries. And that's part of what Mopo are doing, is putting the charging stations in and renting the batteries out. So there's not a major outlay for people in the piece of tech. They're just hiring the use of the power that's generated. So it's a nice model, and kind of, again, reminded me about cooking in Africa. We did a piece several years ago now, talking about the development of economical stoves for use in African nations, where classically they had open fires. And much like across the world before we developed and moved on, three rocks in around the fire was what you stood your cooking pot on. And it was very inefficient use of fuel. So they made these very sort of thick ceramic stove pots, which they can do locally. And basically, they sit their cooking pot on the top of that. They use a lot less fuel, and it's a lot more efficient. So it's got less impact. And also, they do variations on this around Africa now. So there's a twin oven and cooking stove, which I think, from memory, is constructed from 23 house bricks, and a pile of mud and clay, and another pile of sandy soil. So sandy soil to act as a bed, sort of heat-proof, and the clay to bond the bricks into a structure. So you've got a baking oven and you've got a stove. It's brilliant ingenuity, and a lot of the input from Western countries has been developing sort of ideas that were adaptable for those countries to apply. And looking across the world, the loss of woodland in forest or whichever form it comes is a worry.
Mm.
So to reduce the demand on dwindling supplies of sort of wood and fuel, some of the stoves use charcoal to be more efficient. And I think it's just a great sort of positive feel about things, which really is a long way distant from most people in the developed world.
It is. It's basic things.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, there's so much that we take for granted. And, you know, I mean, I think you see all the horror movies where the society breaks down within a very short time of losing things like electricity on demand, water on demand. Great news that we've got an input from our local university again.
It's all good stuff, particularly when they're collaborating with companies. Or the, did they make their own company, did you say? Did they?
No. They have collaborators. With a company that was a startup.
Yeah, so it's the best of both worlds, isn't it? You've got the researchers and the people ready to put that research into action, basically.
Yeah. I mean, we've got so much going on now with the elections and things, talking about growth is the only way out. And this is a great illustration of how we can combine and grow.
Indeed. I mean, Chef Tech College, it's near where BBC Radio Sheffield is. It takes, I think, is it 14 to 18-year-olds? And it gives them an apprenticeship where they're working, you know, they're working with the top research and development.
Yeah,
people,
the UTC. Yeah, they're supplying people to the science park. So, you know, hopefully, it's one of the things, I think, for Sheffield. It was very, very sad that we sort of got to a point where a lot of our major industries were thrown under the wheels of the bus, so to speak, and engineering sort of starting to come back. You know, like we've got a Formula One development team.
Yeah, that's Advanced Manufacturing Park. It's actually, I think it's technically in Rotherham, but it is off the parkway. Oh, there's Boeing there, isn't there? Boeing and McLaren and incredible.
Absolutely, and I think we've talked before about companies like Gripple in Sheffield, which have got a communal aspect of the work that they do in developing their own workforce. And I think, you know, it's a way potentially of moving forward. And quite often, I think in things I've spoken about before, I think we've had a lot of people talked about having a national bank or money facility. And I think early days when I was looking at the development in Japan, they had a different sort of thought process about investing their money in savings for the country. They invested in their savings, but their savings were also used to fund development. A lot of the change that they had, you know, a lot of people here, I think if you were a motorcyclist at the outset of the inrush of Japanese manufactured motorbikes, were screaming about, you know, how terrible it was. And what they did is they used things like Kanban, the development of material supply, the development of things. But quite often it was said what they did was to study things like Triumph motorbikes and copy them and make them better.
Better, yes.
So, and that happened with key things like cameras.
Electronics,
and you know, you can sit on the sidelines and grumble about it, but the thing is, we didn't keep up. One of the key things to that was funding. So I think if we are going to have this wonderful future of development, when I was young, I don't know if you remember
I remember that far back, Paul, I'm not sure I knew.
Well, I kind of remember going and buying what they used to call a lucky dip bag.
Yes, I remember them as well. Ooh. Yes, I'm that old.
Yeah. So,
joy of joys.
You could have a bit of a toy, a bit of a sweetie. Yeah, something else in a lucky dip bag. And I think the problem is that we've treated development in a lot of respects for this country like a lucky dip bag. It's great when you pull out a winner, but then there were an awful lot of rubbish things in those bags as well.
Yeah, but they were still joyous, Paul, to a young child.
The thrill
of it.
It's amazing, you know, what perspective can do in things, but I really think that we have to find a way to channel development, and I really respect something like the MOPO thing, which is a development helping elsewhere. So I think a lot of engineers I know in my sort of electronics days were starting to get fed up with being tied into things like supplying weaponry and stuff. So they started to try and focus developments in areas that were supporting sort of people in illness and other things. And it's amazing how many of those startups, when you've got an idea, are suddenly swallowed up by big conglomerates.
Yeah.
And it was quite often said a lot of developments are how, you know, you created the light bulb, the Edison light bulb, which had its sort of carbon filament and lasted, I think the longest lasting one was getting on 470 years. A light bulb had been lit. So, you know, and then all of a sudden we had lots of people manufacturing light bulbs that were designed with a lifespan.
Exactly. Well, commercialisation. But going back to, you were talking about things we take for granted. One thing I was going to talk about today, but I decided not to, but I will do it on a future show. There's a book, it's going to be published on the 7th of May. I thought this would be right up your street, Paul. It's a book by Dr. Liam Fox, and it's titled The Coming Storm, Why Water Will Write the 21st Century, as in write the story of the 21st century. And it's a fascinating, the article I read, it's mind-boggling about the importance of water and what we take for granted.
It's been one of the things that I know. Sort of harped on about in the past, but at the moment it's controlling water. And I say, you know, with the climate change, we're getting water in quantities and in places
where we don't want it.
We're not used to, and we don't know how to deal with it. And yet there are other places which have a lack of water.
Yeah,
and it's what you can do. And passing thought was whether we've got a finite supply of water or whether we're actually growing or shrinking the amount of water, and I've not really followed that up yet. But
well, wait till I do this. I just knew it would be up your street, Paul, because it made me think when I saw the article about the temperatures in London and the fact, you know, the south of the UK has got the most densely populated areas. And I know in the southeast in particular, around London, when we had droughts and water shortages, they really feel it because the demand, the population demanding the amount of water it demands, sees big issues. And I just, it makes you just think about, it's getting hotter. People, you know, things have got to change, haven't they? I mean,
well, you see it locally, you know. I mean, if you want to go out to our local reservoirs when it's a hot sort of period, they shrink down very low. And you know, it's being proved more and more that we've got an inadequate storage sort of capacity for it. And I think that, let's say, in a lot of respects, if you look into the Middle East, there are a lot of places that rely on desalinating seawater. So just actually looking at the sort of broad spectrum of water and how it arrives to us and how we get rid of it and what we carry away in getting rid of it, just sort of proves that we need to move on. And unfortunately, we rely on Victorian infrastructure.
But, you know, we talked right at the beginning of the show about another UK harvest warning, because a lot of the crop-growing areas have been waterlogged, and yet, you know, potentially you've got a report saying the temperature in London now. It's all odds, isn't it? It's about where you need the water, where you need the right things at the right time, I guess.
Well, it's amazing. If you look at our sort of local rivers, then a lot of that we did have an input from a Dutch water management person, I think, in 1790, who cut canals and drainage to sort of alter the land. And one of the problems that farmers have had is that in Lincolnshire, the Lincolnshire Fens have been filling up and getting waterlogged, where they've been arable farmland. So it's a real sort of control issue in some respects, per se. I think if you look at, I mean, we've talked about it before, that the Netherlands and the way they control water and actually reclaim land.
They did, It's a reclaimed city, yeah.
That sort of talent's around.
Has been for a long time, to be fair.
Yeah, and I say, we've kind of tapped into it from now and again. But I think increasingly we've got to look at how we deal with water. And it's not just the clean supply that comes to your tap, it's the whole thing.
It's the whole, yeah, from beginning to end. Well, I'm going to do that on a future show. I did think about doing it because that book is out on the 7th of May. The Coming Storm, Why Water Will Right the 21st Century by Dr. Liam Fox. It's a fascinating read, Paul. You might have to go out and buy it.
Well, I'm going to look into one interesting thing that cropped up in the catastrophe that's on Fargate. At the moment, that there's actually an information sheet was propped up on the end of one of the things that they were doing, the assemblies, I guess, or whatever it is, saying that part and parcel of why it's taking so long is that it's building in an environmentally friendly drainage solution.
Oh.
So I should love it if anybody from Sheffield Council or the engineers who are putting that in can explain it. Because certainly by looking into the holes that were dug into the ground, the only kind of pipe work I saw going in was for data. Yes, there was a lot of sand went in, which did puzzle me a bit. But I'd love to know what the truth of that is.
We used to know somebody who headed up drainage at Sheffield City Council, but he's retired now. We might have to tap him for some information.
Yeah, tap him.
Brilliant. And on that note, Paul, fantastic stuff. All being well, we'll speak to you bank holiday Monday. Glory days. Yeah. Rock show 1 till 3.
Look forward to rocking.
Rocking bye-bye. Indeed. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Cheers. Bye.
little bit of Status Quo there, would you believe?
Would you believe?
Off vinyl, I think, as well, from our friend Adam, Someone's Learning. And we played that because RPG was updating us on all sorts of science-related news. Just tuned in, you're of course listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also pick up the podcast for the show later. You can share the podcast as well, should you so wish. We are fast coming to the end of this week's edition of the Life Science Radio Show. This bank holiday weekend edition, should I say. The film show are in. They're going to be on next from 12 until 1 o'clock. And don't forget, we'll be back for Glory Days Rock Show 1 till 3 on Monday. Our special guest is Chris Dale, playing, not just punk tracks, something else. But anyway, to finish on, we're going to talk about National Dawn Chorus Day. Who knew? Because I certainly didn't until I read about it.
Yes, that's tomorrow, Sunday, 5th May 2024. Lock your windows, shut your curtains.
No. They are noisy, but they're lovely.
So, anyway, supposedly tomorrow is National Dawn Chorus Day. So the UK's Birdsong Spectacular reaches its peak in early May, just in time for National Dawn Chorus Day, held on the first Sunday in May each year.
And I didn't know that.
No. The Dawn Chorus is a symphony of song performed by birds looking for love and to defend their patch. In spring, as the days lengthen, wildlife starts to think about the need to breed. For many male birds, this means belting out the well-worn but wonderful classics to try and attract females. Then blackbirds at evening are still going when it's dark.
Well, it does say some species sing throughout the day.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's at dawn, as the morning light begins to break, that many different birds join together to perform. And why so early? Well, because birdsong has been shown to carry 20 times further at dawn when it is generally quieter and the air is often... They can cut this out.
Is often still.
Yeah, they can do it when it's the rush hour. Making all the effort to attract a mate much more worthwhile.
So they're doing it when it's generally the quietest time of the day. So that the using
that.
All their energy. No, I didn't until I heard about it. They're using all that effort to attract a mate, and they seem to be much more worthwhile to do it when there's no other noises.
Yeah, it's that one that starts at half past three and finishes at four.
Well, yeah.
So, song thrushers, blackbirds and robins are among the first to rise. Then popular songsters like wrens, they are loud wrens, and warblers such as chiff-chaffs gradually join in, as do wood pigeons.
Indeed. Now, chiff-chaffs is a lot about at the minute if you live in the right sort of areas, and they do make a sound like a chiff-chaff, like that. Anyway, that wasn't very good. Sorry about that. Anyway, while we're talking about National Dawn Chorus Day, which is tomorrow, Sunday the 5th of May, so give them some slack tomorrow. I know it's bank holiday and you want to stay in bed without the birds waking you up early, but just be grateful they are there in the first place.
Yes.
So I'm going to finish today on some more extracts from Chris Packham's Birdwatching Guide, From Beginner to Birder. It's published, it's been out a while actually, $12.99 if you fancy a copy, but here we go. So why do robins have red breasts? Many birds are not particularly colourful, as they want to stay as inconspicuous as possible. In species where competition for mates is strong, the males are generally striking and colourful, at least during the breeding season. At the same time, females' plumage is more restrained. So you can often tell bright plumage then is often a male and more restrained plumage is a female. But the red breast of the robin, territorial robin, is not actually a cheerful flash of colour, but a stark warning to deter other robins from encroaching on its patch without resorting to fighting. If you've got your own garden and you've ever put up, say, a new bird feeder, if the robin finds it first, it will defend it to the hilt. And it's quite vicious, actually, to see. We've got a few robins and we're not quite sure who's with who. And
one dive bombed me the other day.
Yeah, one's got a really quiet song as well. But they're fantastic to see. And one robin in particular generally likes to have a bath in the bird bath when it's raining. So it's like having a bath, but
a
with
shower.
A shower. And it's fantastic to watch. Splays its feathers out. So that's why robins have red breasts. So how do birds stay waterproof? Birds preen their feathers to keep them free of parasites and dirt, moisturise them with an oil they produce naturally, called preen oil so that they stay flexible and strong, and align them in optimum position for waterproofing and flight. Other techniques used to maintain feathers are stretching out the wings, fluffing the feathers, sunbathing, interesting, and bathing in water and dust. Don't underestimate the importance of clean water to birds. Even in the coldest of weathers, they use it to drink, they use it to bath, because it's really important to keep the feathers clean. So how do birds avoid colliding in the air? Some birds, such as starlings and knots, I'm not sure what knots are, I might have to look that up, form flocks that can perform highly synchronized aerial maneuvers. They know when to swerve and when to dive and avoid collisions thanks to their spatial awareness, which is thought to allow each bird to track just the birds around itself, filtering out the rest of its flock. So quite clever. I mean, Chris Packham's an amazing guy anyway.
It's called a murmur, isn't it?
I think for starlings it is, but it's about how they can perform such technical, synchronised manoeuvres. And that's because the thinking is that each bird just tracks the birds around it and chops out the rest of that massive flock. Otherwise, it'd get a bit confused, wouldn't it? Yeah. The next point is why some birds change colour in summer. So although the plumage colours of some birds, such as blackbirds, are relatively constant, other species change their plumage to look their best for breeding season. For most birds, such as starlings, finches and waders, this means dull winter colours, but much brighter hues in summer, with even the colour of the beaks changing in many species. All very interesting stuff. The final point is birds actually team up to find food. Some birds form colonies simply because good nest sites are limited. As for example, a good example is seabird colonies, where they all go together, not necessarily because they want to be so close together, but because there's very limited options for them. So if you go to somewhere like RSPB Bempton Cliffs near Bridlington, they're all packed in, aren't they, on the cliffs. So the same, but if you're not a seabird, other birds flock. Flocking is often to do with food. And that the reason being, many eyes are better than one at finding food, and particularly food that is widely scattered around. So many woodland birds stay territorial in summer when they're nesting and food is plentiful, but flock together afterwards. Some form mixed flocks, would you believe, with things like tits, tree creepers and even woodpeckers coming together for a shared benefit. Amazing stuff, all extracted from Chris Packham's Birdwatching Guide from Beginner to Birder. Good stuff. To you, I Very nice song there. Songbird by Fleetwood Mac. I think it was actually written by Christine McVie as well. Came off Rumours. 1977 was the album. We played that because we're talking about Chris Packham's fascinating facts about birds. And also the National Dawn Chorus Day, which is tomorrow. So cut those birds some slack when they wake you up in the morning. We are fast coming to the end of the Live Science Radio Show. The film show is in the house. Apparently they'll be talking about all sorts of stuff, reviewing films, but also... Our film's too long. That's an interesting one, isn't it? Anyway, before I go, quick reminder, something to do if you've got time to do it. Until 3rd of November this year, there's a fantastic exhibition at Western Park Museum. It's City of Rivers. You know, Sheffield is a city born from its rivers, sculpting the landscape and powering the industries that made it prosper. Today there, the arteries that flow through the urban sprawl continuing to shape the character of the city and our lives in it. From vast reservoirs and cascading weirs to the brooks that trickle through our many green spaces, they also provide a home to a rich abundance of local wildlife. We've been to see this exhibition. It's probably one of the best exhibitions I've ever seen at Western Park Museum, so great credit to them. They've got stuff from all over the place. City of Rivers brings together stories, objects, artwork, film and photography to chronicle Sheffield's relationship with its waterways, drawing on contributions from people across the city. All good stuff. Bye-bye for now.